You're listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast.
On this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast, we go back to the event that just took place a little while ago, conquering the M&A game, M&A for mergers and acquisitions, where now we have panel four. Panel four is after you've made your wealth, what do you do? And before we begin, I just want to let you know there's about 2 to 3 minutes later on the episode where there is a little echo, there's a little feedback from the event. I decided the story was so good, I didn't want to take out the entire segment. So just a heads up to all our listeners out there, when you're listening to this week's episode of the podcast, there is a couple minutes there towards the end that has a little bit of an echo. But with that, let's start this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Silicon Valley Podcast with your host, Sean Flynn, who interviews famous entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and leaders in tech. Learn their secrets and see tomorrow's world today.
For the audience, can we give a little bit more background on each of you, what you're working on, your area of expertise, before we dive into the questions of post-acquisition, what do you do now? Michael, do you want to go first?
Yeah, my name is Michael Firestone. I'm managing partner of a firm called Fire Capital. So we provide investment advisory and consulting services to, I'll call it, multi-generational wealth and also private foundations.
I'm Sophie Sang. I'm a residential real estate broker with Compass based in Palo Alto and been in the business for 21 years. I help clients navigate their process of buying or selling residential real estate.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jeannie Colclough. I'm the owner of Riveting Trips. I am a Condé Nast top travel specialist. I create bespoke luxury travel for my clients and anybody else.
So first question for everyone. Okay, the deal has just closed. Many of these people have more money than they could imagine in their bank accounts. What's some of the biggest mistake people that have just come into wealth make? I see a little smile on Michael. Do you want to start?
Sure. Wealth is an interesting concept, right? Because what wealth is to each of you probably means something different to the other person. It's like risk. It's very arbitrary and personal. I'll just start with asking a question, right? So how many of you know what it would take in terms of total net worth to be in the top 1% of the United States?
He opened up to the audience.
360,000.
Yeah.
Top 1%. Higher. 10 billion. Lower. 1 million. It's $11 million of net worth. And that sounds like a lot of money to a lot of people here. It depends. I've got clients that have 50 million and they live like they're broke. They're not, but they act that way. It really does depend. And in terms of risks, mistakes, things that people make, there's so much that needs to be done up front, right? And we talked a lot about those things, but really thinking about how you're going to construct your investment portfolio, who's going to do it for you after the fact is quite important. We spend a lot of time on certain things and not a lot of time on important things. For example, when I was growing up, used to go up to Upper Michigan, beautiful Lake Superior, would go see my grandmother every summer. And I still swear she is the best cook I've ever met. I have her recipes. I try to make those recipes all the time. I don't even come close. I could give everyone in this room 5 ingredients right now, and we could all cook the same thing. And there is going to be a slug of dishes that are just that much better than everybody else. So the point is that the details matter, and they matter even more significantly when we're talking about wealth and really like your financial livelihood. And just using that $11 million mark, let's make it 10 to make the math a little bit easier. Think about what 1% is of that in dollar terms, right? Think about $100,000 a year. Let's cut it in half, right? $50,000. You compound that over a very long period of time, a 50 basis point mistake can be a huge difference in what your overall wealth is. And how do you fix that? You think about fees. You think about how much you're hiring your advisor for. What are they buying for you? You're thinking about returns. Is this person 50 basis points better than the other person that you're thinking about hiring? Are you thinking about after-tax returns? There's so many things I could get into, but I'm going to stop rambling and let somebody else answer that as well.
Sophie, biggest mistakes you've seen people make after they come to this windfall of money because of that exit?
I think it's probably the false sense of confidence that they know how to deal with their money. And since I'm in real estate, I can only talk about real estate. I would say begin with the end in mind. If investment or real estate investment is what you would like to do, line yourself up with the experts and just be open-minded and take in advice and not just assume you know everything because you happen to be one of the lucky ones and have a lot of money in the pocket.
And Jeannie, before, if you wanted to add anything, everyone in the back, don't forget, we got the whole floor. You guys can hang out, a lot of chairs, tables, private rooms, that if you want to network, go. But yeah, it got real quiet real quick. All right, Jeannie.
So for me, I think normally most of the clients that come to me already have their wealth pre-established and they haven't just gotten wealthy overnight, so to speak. So they don't make those kinds of irrational decisions as they would like in investments or real estate. They've already been accustomed to spending a certain kind of cash on their yearly travels. So I don't really deal with that kind of clientele right now.
No one booking a trip to a war zone area or anything like that?
No, I would highly advise, and you can't buy travel insurance for that, so not going to happen.
Michael, what about...
Can I just add to the mistakes? And Sophie, I think, mentioned real estate. She mentioned overconfidence. We're talking about exits. We're talking about liquidity events, things that can happen. I often see a decent amount of overconfidence when it comes to either founders or early employees that effectively there was an IPO and they feel so confident that they're part of the best company that has ever laid ground in Silicon Valley. And the data tells you something very different, that it doesn't matter how great your company is. These folks like to hold on to these because they want to continue to build wealth that way, because that's how they've done it so far. And they know their company quite well. They know the ins and outs. Once that security hits the public markets, it's a whole different ballgame. Most IPOs are unprofitable. That's okay. However, there's plenty of research. You go back to 2010 to 2020. When you are exiting through an IPO, you have a 3 to 6 month lockup. You can't sell it. After that, you're able to do it. A lot of people still want to hold it. After 6 months, the data says that really 50% of those are going to do worse than what you could have other done otherwise. After 3 years, it jumps to 70%. And that 30% that actually outperformed the market 3 years later, no matter how great the company, really that top decile of those IPOs are the ones that really carried it. And the names are endless. You think about Snowflake, for example. Great company, very hyped up. It is still not back to the trading price that it exited at. I was part of Facebook at the very beginning. Everyone was very excited about Facebook in the IPO. Did terrible for a long time. Now it's done well. But the point is that overconfidence matters, and transitioning over to assets like real estate, particularly for high net worth investors, does make sense. There's tax deferral benefits. There's a lot you can gain from really diversifying your portfolio into things that, frankly, when you have more money, you have more options, more availability.
To continue that, what does someone need to know to create generational wealth? What are their options?
So again, generational wealth, right? The concept of wealth, very arbitrary. I'll say this, especially as a business founder, a business owner, somebody who's really grinded to make that money. And any good founder, any good business owner, you hear their stories and they effectively went through a war to effectively get to where they were at. It wasn't easy. There was an interview not too long ago with Jensen Huang, CEO of NVIDIA. And the question was, thinking back to when you started, what would you do differently? His answer was, I wouldn't do it. And we're talking about one of the most successful companies in the world. He wouldn't do it. It's too hard. If he knew what he knew today, he wouldn't do it. So you really take that kind of thought process, that mentality, and you kind of transition over to the concept of, hey, I've taken the risk. I've done everything I can, then it becomes not just how much more money can I make, it's also about risk management, because things happen. Things can happen quickly. Everyone talks about the financial crisis where we lost 50%+ in the markets. Does anyone know how much money it takes or how much return to get back to even if you lose 50%? It takes 100%. All right, losses hurt more than gains. It's not just psychological, that's real. So considering where you're at and how risky you want to be, and you've heard this over and over again from the panelists, is quite important.
Staying on risk, Sophie, is there any risk to investing in real estate? It's a softball question.
I heard someone say no. There's definitely a risk in any type of investment. The thing that's different from compare real estate to stocks, that real estate will not become zero all of a sudden. And a stock price can actually go negative. So in that sense, there's more security in the real estate piece of real estate. And so if someone is thinking about investing in real estate, and I would say ask around people who actually hold investment properties, talk to them instead of just reading online or getting false information. And as far as...
You forgot the question. Maybe the risk that maybe people are unaware of when they look into investing in real estate or commercial real estate.
First time sitting on a panel. When I went into real estate about 21 years ago, I took a class and learned about passive income. I would say it's probably more like holding stocks. You pick a good stock and you hold. And I would say that's the same thing about real estate. What would be risky is people, when people focus on the short-term gain and wanted to do flipping. And if there's a market downturn, then that's when the risk is just really high. If you buy a good piece of property location and just keep in mind, this is a long game.
Jeannie, question for you. Let's get on a more happier note here. Big payday. You've been working this company that you founded 15 years. You've never had a vacation for 5 years. They come to you and they go, I don't know what to do. What advice do you give them? How do you plan that first trip?
Okay, so normally with my clients, I have a pretty long discussion, right? Actually, I ask them, what are your dreams? What are your hopes? What do you want to achieve on this vacation? I tell them, what are your likes, dislikes? What, if you've ever been on a vacation before, what did you like about it? So based on that, then we whittle down, then we tell, ask them, like, are you a beach person? Are you a city person? Do you drink alcohol? Yes, I do. Do you not, right? That kind of stuff. So we figure out their likes and dislikes and I create a list. But some of the kind of crazier ones are if you like to ski and surf, you can do that. You can ski in one place and then you get helicoptered to another location where you can surf. I've seen some clients book out Richard Branson's private island, the villa. You can access that too if you wanted to. You just, everything has a price, right? If you want to have access to the villa, I have clients charter private jets for travel. Pretty much anything that you think you want to do, you can do. So really, the sky's the limit.
Michael, going back to you, you'd said something that was pretty interesting about if you lose 50% of your money, you need 100% to get back up. What goes on with those people that had exited their company and they think, I really don't have any future source of income other than what I got from this sale? What happens in those discussions?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it definitely matters what their goals are, what type of income they're trying to generate, where they live, right? California, you're going to structure a portfolio drastically different than, let's say, Florida, or if you're an offshore client. Again, taxes certainly matter. There's different schools of thought when it comes to building portfolios and asset allocation. Traditional finance, I'm not going to get too deep into it, this mean variance concept of expected returns versus risk. There's this other side that's more behavioral in sense. And I think for a lot of folks, the behavioral side makes more sense to them and they're able to stick to it better, which is more important. So we talk a lot about bucketing money. So we will bucket a source, a chunk of that portfolio to generate income. And ideally it's tax exempt or tax deferred income, again, potentially real estate, potentially other assets. When the client knows that their income needs are satisfied through a fairly, let's say, defensive or safe source, they're willing to take more risk on the other side. And then you get into things like private alternatives, equity, where do you go, tax loss harvesting, right? And you start thinking about, again, now you are able to access in types of investments that you were never able to access before. You could buy an ETF, yeah. Or you could do a separately managed account that mimics the S&P and throws off tax losses. Most people can't do that unless you have a lot of money, but that's available and it's pretty cheap to do. Private alternatives, big opportunity in private alternatives, outsized returns, lower volatility, but the winners and losers between the two are just absolutely massive. So you have to pick the right ones at the end of the day. So I know I'm deviating a little bit from the income discussion, but it all plays together at the end of the day. And usually they have multiple entities that you need to consider in terms of how they all work together, who the beneficiaries are, what the goals are of each.
Dive in a little bit deeper on there. When talking to someone, say our first panel today was preparing for your exit. And we talked to Jane, we talked to Sherry about talking to the wealth advisors, that number on that exit to plan. What are the different kind of size amounts for that owner when they sell to have options open up for them? What I mean by that is if you sell and you only get $1 million from the sale versus $5 million versus 10 versus 50, how does talking to someone like yourself differ? At what points are those differences?
Yeah, I've been so fortunate in my career, lucky in a lot of ways to work with incredible people who have created their wealth, people who have inherited their wealth, just really amazing people, philanthropic people, the above. And in terms of size, right, like when different types of opportunities open up, we have an example right now. We have a client that just inherited $10 million. He's very interested in doing seed investments, early stage stuff. This is life-changing money for him. And for us, doing that type of investment obviously is risky. Our role and the way we look at it is we're there to advise the client. We're there to make recommendations. It's their money at the end of the day. So we're going to execute on whatever type of risk strategy that they want. With that said, let's say, especially with private alternatives, and going back to the bucketing concept, let's say 20% of your total portfolio makes sense. Let's say it's a $10 million portfolio. You get to $2 million that you can allocate to private alternatives. Like stocks, like bonds, ideally you're diversifying across that. You're not just buying a single fund, a single investment, betting it all, right? You're like your lotto ticket. Nobody's going to spend $2 million on lotto tickets. Effectively, we think about programmatic alternative investing over a long period of time, which helps reduce the risk. It takes out the timing aspect, right? You hit a bad time in the economy. You're looking at the cash flows, the types of funds, when the cash is being returned to the investor. You layer diversification within that. And you can't really do that with $2 million. $10 million sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But again, going back to my comment about just the range of good managers versus bad managers in the alternative space versus, let's say you look at active equity managers, it's like this. And I've got a really great chart I'd love to share with you guys. If any of you want to contact me, I'll send it to you, but it really speaks to that. And effectively, some of the best alternative managers have very high minimums. Like we've done investments with Elliott Hedge Fund. We don't love hedge funds, but Elliott, it's one of the top $10 million minimum. You have to have a lot of money to be able to do that type of stuff. It's a she.
Question from the audience there. Jeannie, question. Do you ever get clients that trip before the exit in preparation for after the exit, maybe move abroad, maybe plan to live in Portugal after, who knows?
I do have clients that are looking to maybe have different passports, if that makes sense, especially during different times in the US. So some people have left the United States, and then Portugal is a good country to have gone to. You could have gotten the EU golden visa. during when, if you invest, I think you've bought a home for 300,000 euros in either Porto, Lisbon, and Alentejo, but now the Portuguese government has rescinded that because there's way too many non-Portuguese people buying those properties. But yeah, if you have that kind, I do have sometimes clients that go on those kind of search and seek vacations and see if this is somewhere I would actually like to live and then live part-time. There's a surgeon I know. He was just in Goa, India. He's a surgeon in the UK. And I said, why are you working your butt off and not traveling? You should enjoy the money. I'm a firm believer in traveling while you can and you're physically fit to do it. Because if you wait till you're too late, or you say you're going to hold off until I'm richer, I retire, it's generally not a good idea, right? For everything that I've seen, all the clients that I have that come to me that are a little bit older, they're not really traveling. They're essentially replicating their lifestyle here somewhere else. And I don't think that's really a joyful holiday. It's just a very wealthy vacation, but it's not, you can't go out there, meet the locals, entertain yourself, go to a show, go to a flamenco show or something like that, or go wine tasting or have a pasta making class or go on a yacht, private yacht, right down the Douro River. There's a certain kind of travel. I think traveling is about learning about different cultures, learning about different kinds of people, expanding your world, realizing that we are more interconnected than we are separate. So I've been dragging my kids. They're going to kill me now. Almost 12 and 10. And they've been traveling with us ever since they were infants. And I think that just the idea of a global citizen is really important in today's society, especially if you're going to be in business, doing business with people from different cultures, different backgrounds. Just because I was raised in the Bay Area doesn't mean I always feel like I'm from the Bay Area, you know what I mean? So I think you feel more connected to home when I'm actually traveling, if that makes sense. I feel more Bay Area or Californian. And I always get crap from people when I meet overseas, there are other Americans and like Europeans or Asians are asking me, where are you from? And I say California. And I don't say the US, right? I say California. I say specifically SF Bay Area. And then the non-Californians in the group are like,
California.
I think we're a great country. Sorry, I said not a great country. We're a great state. California or bust. But I think there's more out there. And if you can explore it and you can do it while you have some cash and you're not waiting to be crazy rich, then you should enjoy that time.
Sophie, quick question for you before we wrap it up. One, what questions do potential clients ask you? And then let's go around the group and just give a story or a piece of advice before wrapping it up. So Sophie, do you want to? I'm giving everyone time to think of it.
I work both the buyer side and also the seller side. With this audience, I assume more people are thinking about buying real estate. I'll speak to that. A lot of buyers would ask me, there are two questions they often ask me. If they don't already have a primary home, they would ask me, should I buy a primary home first or buy a rental property first? The other question they ask me is, where in the country will get the most appreciation that I should invest in? Regarding the first question, my opinion is I think someone should buy their own home first before investing. And it just, for a lot of reasons, it just makes sense because when you are ready to buy a second property, you have more tools in your box. And the second question regarding which part of the country I can get the most bang out of my buck. Really, who knows, right? It's more of if you have family members over that side of the country, you would like to buy a property that's nearby or eventually retiring over there, then that's a consideration. It's definitely a good direction to go to. But if you look at the United States alone, if you just draw a line from DC to San Francisco, the population is moving towards south. When there is limited supply and a lot of demand, that's where the appreciation will happen. And So just by talking to a real estate professional and express to them your needs, and that will clear your mind and get some advice from that.
Fantastic. Jeannie, Michael, do you want to share a little story? And
yeah.
Okay, so I'm putting me on the spot here. Last year, I helped a father and son, and this is why I think you should travel while you physically can, right? The son reached out to me and said that he wanted to spend an X number of dollars taking his father to Korea and Japan. And his father had not been to Korea essentially since he had immigrated to the U.S. The father was living in Washington. The son was living in the Bay Area, like Oakland. And they found me online, and I said, sure, I can help you. But what kind of experience do you want? What kind of experience can you have? He was afraid that his father actually couldn't walk because he was actually practicing for this trip by having his dad. He would go up to Washington, right, and walk with his dad several blocks to see if he could get his dad's stamina up to do this trip. And I told him, have you been to Tokyo? Have you been to Korea? Have you been to Seoul where there's a gazillion steps? And yes, there's public transit, but it's not the easiest. Nobody wants to go through the Byzantine of five stairs in Seoul just to get to the subway. So I told him, I said, we can do this. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. The easy way will require a little bit more flexibility in your income. And he was fine with it because he essentially said, this is going to be my dad's last trip abroad. His dad had already determined he's not going to really travel after this. And I think, will I ever get to that point where I already know I'm going to start limiting my travel. I'm not going to want to go on a plane. I'm not going to want to do this. So it was a very foreign concept to me. Actually, I've recently had more clients like that kind of contact me too, who are trying to take their parents to their one last hurrah of a trip. The father and the son, they splurged on hotels. Essentially, they stayed in suites in Tokyo, Seoul, Osaka, Son. And then they hired, I told them, you need for your father to hire a driver, to hire guides to come to you to do this, because the son was not accustomed to traveling that way. And so the son was like a little bit reluctant. I said, look, you've already blown all this cash on the hotels. Let's spend some money on the land package too. So when he was there, he was really happy because my partners that I work with overseas. Sorry, my bad. Oh, what happened was that the partners that I work with, the father had a medical emergency while he was traveling, right? He's 87 years old, had to go to see a dentist and a doctor during his trip in Tokyo, right? And if he had been there by himself and they had just rented or stayed in the hotels, they would just go with the concierge. And in fact, they tried to do the concierge route first. And I told him, I said, look, you need to like WhatsApp me or Kakao talk me or whatever and tell me like you have issues going on. So fortunately, he contacted me. I contacted my land provider who actually got the dentist appointment and the doctor's appointment secured before the hotel concierge could. So they rerouted the entire holiday for him. I've heard of other scenarios where like worst case scenario, you have to bring someone's body back. I'm not to deal with that, but I do know that is a possibility too on vacations, right? You don't want to think about that on a happy thing, but generally I think you have to be prepared for the worst case scenario, but hope for the best, really. And when he came back, he was, oh my God, I'm so glad. Thank you for all this stuff. I can't believe I doubted you. And can you give props to your people in Korea and Japan? So I think you hire me for my connections to people who are going to provide that best service. And I will provide as much handholding as you want. If you don't want handholding, you say, just Jeannie, just tell me where to go, which hotel, I'll do that. If you want lots of massaging and handholding and you want to feel safe, I'm actually working with a mother, a single mom, and her daughter. She got her daughter's Taylor Swift tickets and they're going to go to Netherlands, but she wants to go do other things. And then she says, I want this for my daughter because she just came out of a nasty divorce. And I said, I got you. I hear you. And she wants to feel safe and secure while she's traveling because it can just be her and her daughter. So I think there's certain things that I understand as a former solo single female traveler to now traveling with my children and traveling with elderly people and grandparents and stuff. Yeah.
Since we're about on time, let's go down this. But Jeannie, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, how should they go about doing it?
My company is called Riveting Trips. I'm on all the socials. I really don't use them a whole lot, but you find me there. or I'm on LinkedIn, or you can find me, if you're a ProVisor member, you can find me on that, or you can just come up to me afterwards and get my contact information.
All right, Sophie, store your some advice, and how can people reach you?
So Sophie Tsang, my last name is T-S-A-N-G. And if you want to email me, it's just sophie@compass.com. And I also want to mention that Compass is the number one brokerage in the country. Anywhere in the country, if you need a good realtor, within minutes, I can connect you to someone good over there. And I'm on LinkedIn. And also, I think I'm on ProVisor. I'm in Sean's group and also SF12.
Great. Michael?
Just briefly, I'd say that if you're in that top 1%, and then there's the other 99%, which most of us are in, you got to think that you probably have different and more unique circumstances that need extra attention. Again, those details matter tremendously. And very few people in this room are actually equipped with the knowledge, not that they're not brilliant at what they do, but very few are equipped to know what details are effectively important. So finding someone you can trust, you're not going to trust somebody from a meeting or from a pitch deck. My team talks about this all the time. Trust is earned. It can be lost very quickly. And effectively, find someone that you can grow with, that you like, that you're willing to share and open up to. Because the more of that somebody is giving to an advisor, the more that they can help you. And there are lots of different ways, whether it be tax, investments, travel, real estate. I think likability is very important when you're doing business with people.
Can we get applause for the panel up here?
Thank you for listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast. To access our resources, visit us at thesiliconvalleypodcast.com. And follow our host on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Sean Flynn SV. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. Thank you for listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast. To access our resources, visit us at thesiliconvalleypodcast.com and follow our host on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Sean Flynn SV. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional.